Good morning, all. It's another beautiful day. Your attention, please.
Hey there, welcome back to Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. Today we meet the girl who was deaf, and I'd like to tell you up front that we had a bit of a recording issue where halfway through our show, our recording just stopped. So there's a very abrupt cut right in the middle, but it's all good, it's all there. Just, you know, don't let it bother you that much. In the notes this week, we have some very helpful links to help you follow along with next week's episode, where we cover a couple episodes of Danger Man as kind of a breather before we get into the finale. So you definitely want to check that out at backinthevillage.com. But aside from that, that's about it. Enjoy The Girl Who Was Deaf. Good morning, good morning. We are here on a lovely, muggy, overcast Memorial Day to talk about The Prisoner. This episode is The Girl Who Was Deaf, and we are Clay and Wes from Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. How are you doing, Wes?
Good, Clay. How are you? Happy Memorial Day.
Thank you. Thank you. No better way to spend it than inside with a microphone in your face.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the summer has come to Boston, I think. It's starting to get muggy. It's starting to get... It hasn't rained in a couple weeks, though, huh?
Yeah, it looks like it's coming pretty soon, though.
We're going to be sad.
Yeah.
Anyway, The Girl Who Was Deaf.
The girl who... I'm sorry, what? Excuse me? Speak up again.
Girl Who's Deaf, we're at episode 15 at
15,
this point, out
yes,
of 17.
We've got two more left. We're coming in on the hard landing here.
Yeah.
This week's episode was written by Terrence Feely from an idea by David Tomlin, and it was directed by David Tomlin.
Feely wrote something before, right?
His name yeah, seems he has another one, at least one other one. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Directed by Tomlin. And number two this week was a guy named Kenneth Griffith, but he's not really in it very much. The person we should probably talk about is the girl, whose name is Justine Lord, because she is the chief antagonist for this very strange episode. For, mm-hmm. This is...
Tracy Lord's less famous sister. Huh? I actually know Justine Lord. I was looking at her IMDb. She was... She acted and then retired in the 70s, but came back in her final appearance is like a Young Ones episode from 82, and I love the Young Ones.
I don't think I know that show.
It's a BBC, they called it like an anarcho sitcom. It's like this surreal, crazy sitcom, and she plays, one of the characters in the show goes into a wardrobe and ends up in like an altered Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe scene, and she's the witch in the...
Oh, well, that would fit right in with this episode, because this is kind of like... an alternate reality episode of The Prisoner, sort of. It's very strange. I don't know if it's if we should talk about how the ending, because it makes the rest of the episode make more sense.
Yes. Well, here's the... I laughed because this episode is how I wanted Living in Harmony to basically end. It's sort of a similar idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it happened, I was like, oh, that feels... real similar that they actually did that again. But instead of a dream sequence, he's sort of a waking dream. He's awake and making a dream sequence.
Right. He's after all the craziness of the episode, which we'll get into, there's a motif going into it where the first shot is two hands opening a children's book onto a painting, an illustration of a cricket match. And that motif continues every act break. You see another shot of the children's book with something similar to what's happening, but not exactly an illustration of what's happening on the screen.
Yep.
And then at the end, you pull back and you see that this whole crazy story that's happened is number six, telling a bedtime story to the children of the village.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I would like to get into as well because I have some thoughts about that. And that sort of, once you get to that point, the wackiness that comes before it makes a little bit more sense, or at least it seems less out of place.
Yeah.
But even so, this is a very strange episode.
Cause I remember last week we were Living in Harmony where if you haven't listened to that episode, my whole thing was I almost wished that he was dreaming the whole thing at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that for Living in Harmony. And now I don't know, because now that I've seen, like, it really does just negate everything you see when when a story flips itself like that. Like, even if you think it thematically makes sense, to have that reveal is, like, very unsatisfying, sort of, at the end.
Yes. But at the same time, you know, I've actually, when I started watching this episode, I started in my head writing it off pretty quickly, because it's so goofy, it's so different and odd, and it's just, it seems like the definition of a filler episode.
Yes.
But when I got to the end, I think I've thought about this episode more than I've thought about a lot of the other ones.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of kind of ways you can interpret and deal with what they did. By the time I got to the end, I was thinking, well, does this ending negate everything, or does it actually enhance everything? Because what he's kind of doing is, the point of the episode was, in, we can get to this later too, but the worst plot to get number six to resign or to give information that I think they do in the whole show.
Yeah, it's very, it's a real spitball meeting that they were like, this one, all right.
But they just, number two just says, put him in a room with children. We thought he'd open up. That didn't work.
Wait, what does he say? He wouldn't open up to his grandmother or something? He's like, this number six. Yeah, it's funny, when he said that, I had to, like, refresh. I was like, wait a minute, what? I thought there was a deeper thing than what was actually going on. I was like, wait, how would he say it? Oh, never mind. He's put them in a room with kids.
Yeah, it was like, it's a very, not very well thought out plan.
Children, let me tell you why I resigned.
Right. But the thing that made me think about it was, okay, well, clearly, if you look at this episode from the point of view of Six knows what they're doing. He knows this is a trick. He knows they're trying to get information out of him. So what does he do? He just fucks with them and makes up this. He's talking to kids, but he also knows that number two is listening and expects some sort of, like, secret history from him.
Yep.
So he creates this whacked out children's story fantasy version of, like, a secret agent thing.
Yep.
And that's what he puts across. So not only is it a children's story, but it's also a big middle finger to the village.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, I was like, you know what? That actually makes me like this episode a lot more. Because I think, well, let's talk about what actually happens in the show before we get into our dissecting of it.
Sure. I just wanted to make one other point before I forget about it. I guess the Goodnight Children is kind of a famous thing that a radio program in Britain would sign off with.
Oh, really?
So I think that they're sort of satirizing that at the end.
Well, too. He definitely is breaking the fourth wall.
Yep.
And, you know, we can talk about what that means, if anything, you know, in a little bit.
Sure.
Busy, Potter?
It's our former Siberia.
What was the colonel up to?
Dr. Snips, crazy scientist. For the last 26 years, he's been building a super rocket to destroy London.
Where?
Well, it's just what the colonel was about to find out. Excuse me. Ridiculous.
As I mentioned, at the beginning, children's book opens up on an illustration of a cricket match. Then we go into the book in what is probably the most English opening to any show ever, possibly, which is just basically a 10-minute cricket scene.
on a sort of weird, because there's enough people to be watching, but they don't seem to be on a legitimate cricket pitch, because the I don't know what you call it, the outfield of cricket is basically just bushes.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a very limiting.
It's like they're playing cricket in someone's backyard.
Right. Yeah.
It needs to be limited, because the plot point of what happens is this mustachioed man hits the ball into the brush.
Is it a requirement for cricketers to have bizarre facial hair? Because he when he becomes the cricketer, if that's what they're even called.
I have some information about that as well, which we can get to. So the mustachioed cricketer hits the ball. I'm sure we're using totally accurate.
He struck it with his Veldesmere. Knocked it. It came short of the century mark, which is apparently a huge.
I believe they call it smithing. So he smithed it into the woods. And when the ball goes into the woods, a mysterious hand replaces it with another ball.
Yeah.
Then the outfielder, I guess, or the outfield tricks, if you're English.
Yep.
Throws the ball back to the bowler. I think that's actually correct.
Yeah, I think bowler is
that is correct.
1 out of 10.
Who then bowls it or pitches it or smites it towards the whack tricks, which I believe is what they call the person with the
bat.
He shoots the J. But this time, when it hits the rim, the ball explodes and kills the mustachioed cricket man.
Yep, who's Colonel Hockey, right? Is that
right,
his name?
Yet another colonel. Apparently, I don't know if that's the only level of power in the military that the people who use the show are familiar with, but it's always a colonel. It's never anything higher, except for the one episode with the general.
Yeah.
He was a robot, so that doesn't count.
It's not the word you want to type into your script either. Colonel's not an easy word to spell consistently correct. So it's like, then lieutenant, all the military ranks are kind of hard to spell.
At least I think sergeant is probably a trickier one.
Lieutenant is very difficult.
Yeah, lieutenant. Although that's why it's probably lieutenant.
Yeah.
Which is easier.
Ensign,
yeah. So after this cricketer is exploded,
yep.
We meet number 6.
Well, we also in the cricketer, the guy watching the cricketer has been making eyes with this woman, who's our first introduction.
Right.
This.
Yeah, and there's I watched that scene back actually a couple times because I was trying to figure out because the guy who's keeping score,
yep,
for the cricket match has a gun in his case, as well as a pair of binoculars, yeah, which he uses to look at the guy, the cricket guy, the cricketer, the cricketrix, the batsman, and who kind of like gives him a wink and twirls the mustache or something.
Yeah.
And then he pans over to the legs of an attractive woman.
Yep.
Now, who does he know either of them? For some reason, on the first pass, I got the impression that he knew the colonel, but not the woman.
I got the impression, because he sees the woman first, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't think he knows who the woman is, although I don't know why. He's obviously like a spy informant, so I don't know why he brought his gun to this if he doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
But he sees the woman, and he's just looking at her legs. It does the camera trick of like panning up and down her legs.
I assume off screen, his head turns into a wolf.
Yeah.
And his tongue flies out, and his eyes budge out.
And it rolls up like one of those curtains.
And one of those auga horns goes off.
And then he looks at the cricketer, and the cricketer gives him a look back that if it was like, I don't know if it was supposed to be intentionally comedic or something. Like the cricketer kind of gives him like, what do you look like? Kind of a like flirty, what are you looking at?
Yeah.
As he twirls his mustache.
But I mean, I can only assume that the two of them are on like working together.
Cricket player?
Yeah. Because the cricket player is, as we find out in the next scene, is a secret agent. And the guy who's keeping the score has a gun in his bag. So
I guess
it doesn't matter.
But. No, it doesn't. I think, well,
it's just a little confusing.
It's just the gun, right? Because you wouldn't have a question unless he didn't bring his gun to this.
Right.
Because you assume he thinks something's going to go down.
Right. Anyway, doesn't matter, but it was interesting, kind of a little confusing to kind of parse that out. If you have any thoughts, feel free to email us.
And let us know what hitting the century is, if that's a huge accomplishment, because I don't know what that would be the equivalent of. Is that like Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game or something?
Well, the points on the board, I think, were like, I don't know what the scoring system is in cricket,
but it
went from like 93 to 98 after with that one hit or something.
Well, I think cricket scores are in the hundreds when it's all said and done. So
oh, really?
I don't know if one guy scoring 100 points in like an at bat is a good. It obviously seems to be good, but I don't know if that's like a record or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess it was getting close to 100, so it probably has something to do with that. And feel free to correct all of our. I'm pretty sure our cricket terminology is accurate, but just in case it's not.
It will be good because the correction will make less sense than the fiction I've created in my head when someone's like, no, actually, you score 7 squared points every time you get a Vanda Smurf.
Yeah. And you can say this because your father's British.
Yeah, that's right. This is all 100% accurate.
So yeah, after he gets blown up, we meet Six, who is in a very traditional secret agent kind of role, and he meets up. He gets his newest assignment from a record player much like in Mission Impossible or something, where he goes in and he puts... Actually, it's very similar to what he does in Hammer and Anvil, when he goes and he picks the record and he starts listening to the record and writing stuff down. Only this time, the record does have a message for him, and it also talks back to him.
Yes.
Which was funny.
Which is beyond Mission Impossible, what Mission Impossible considered possible.
And after that, he goes and he meets the shoeshine boy, whose name is Potter, who is played by a guy who played the same character name in Danger Man, thus adding to all of the confusion about what means what and how the shows are connected, but we'll get to that later. And he learns about the cricketer and his... Now I'm picturing like a cricket guy with a rocket pack and a cool helmet. Anyway, he learns that the mission was to... It doesn't even really matter, but it's like there's a guy developing a long-distance missile, and he was trying to get information on this guy.
Yep.
But now he's dead, so Six has to take his place.
The guy's name is Schnapps or Schnips or something?
Yeah, I don't know. Schiff, I don't know.
Right, so...
Lashif.
He's trying to develop a rocket to blow up London.
Yeah.
And he's not in London?
I don't know.
Is that what we're supposed to... He seems to be in Britain.
Maybe.
Okay. So
it could be a short distance rocket.
It just goes up and falls back down again, like those bottle rockets.
Mission: find and destroy Professor Schnipp's rocket.
There's very little help I can give you, I'm afraid. The opposition have been one step ahead of us all along.
Thank you very much.
What was that?
Nothing.
Standard disguise. Take over where the colonel left off.
But so taking this guy's place is like literal, because the very next scene we see Six in a very similar gigantic mustache, mustache connecting to sideburns, Lemmy from Motorhead style beard, playing cricket. And the same thing goes down where the ball gets replaced, but Six is ready for it, and he, hucks it into the woods and it explodes. And when it explodes, it leaves him a note on a handkerchief. And from that point on, it starts this back and forth with this woman who is the titular girl who was Death, where they go through a very, very traditional... Well, it's not really traditional, but it's much more common to, like, an episode of The Avengers.
Yeah.
Sort of back and forth secret agent thing where she's constantly leaving him notes about, egging him on and clues about where to go. There's one little thing that I actually would love, a pint glass... that at the bottom of it says, "You have just been poisoned."
Yep.
That was a good one. It reminded me of The Prestige.
Yep.
When Hugh Jackman's drinking the beer and the card is stuck to the... That was good. but it's that kind of thing. And for the second half of the episode, Six is dressed as Sherlock Holmes, but like Sherlock Holmes by way of Austin Powers, because he's got like this frilly cravat on.
Yep.
And Alexis Kanter makes an uncredited appearance as a guy on a roller coaster yelling at Six for scoping out his woman.
Oh, okay.
It's basically just this chase putting Six through all these progressively surreal challenges.
Yep.
It brings him to a town with three shops in a row that are the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker.
Oh.
There's a car chase scene, or at least, a car chase on a blue screen, where the girl, leans over the back and points to him as he's chasing her and starts twirling her finger.
Yep.
And they cut over to Six, and the blue screen background starts spinning.
Yep. Yep.
For no reason.
he's going, whoa.
Yeah. And then he's, there's a point where he ends up in a trap involving exploding candles and machine gun fire.
And electrified Mortal Kombat spike pits.
Yes. And all of this leads him to a very strange ending where he tracks her back to where this rocket is being put together by the girl's father, who is Napoleon.
Yes.
And has a team of henchmen also dressed as Napoleon inside of a lighthouse rocket. And he's very, I don't really know how to describe, how would you describe his acting? It's very over the top and stylized.
Yeah, he's like, he's kind of like a mad scientist, sort of. Yeah. He's not dressed like a mad scientist, but he's got like a very like, maha, my dear, as soon as we do this, this will happen.
Yeah, he's not quite Captain Hook in the stage production of Peter Pan, where he's not quite, you know, over the top and foppish.
Yep.
But he's kind of in that vein.
Yeah. And his henchmen are all non-English UK people.
Yeah, there's one Irish guy who you know he's Irish because he was singing Danny Boy.
Irish, Welsh, I think there's a Scots, and then there's like a Northern England guy.
I should say the ADR guy was singing Danny Boy because that had some of the worst dubbing I've ever seen.
Six also was horribly dubbed in this one, too.
There's a lot of bad dubbing for like piecing stuff together where, you know, you're looking right at his face and he's not singing something, but the audio is him singing. Then Six spends about, I don't know, 15 to 20 minutes taking all the firing pins out of the guns.
Yep, punching people slowly out as they come into the room and dropping them down the hole.
Reversing all the grenades.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure that doesn't work that way, but whatever. He actually kills people in this episode.
Who's he kill?
Well, I guess technically the guys who fire the guns.
Yeah.
It's not clear whether or not they die.
Yeah.
Because the guns just backfire and they all fly away.
I guess it just knocks them down.
But
he kills those two, yeah.
Yeah, at the end he escapes, but I forget exactly how. The girl and the scientist, Napoleon guy, do not escape and the bomb just goes off.
Yeah, because Six was turning so many dials that the machine starts to smoke.
He just goes in and hits all the buttons and breaks the machine, and it blows up, and I assumingly killing Napoleon and his daughter.
Very similar to Star Trek Generations. He just kind of locked the missile into place, and it blew up without any
sense. So from that point, we get a pullout to see that Six is actually in a room full of children, and he has been using this children's book as a basis for this story he's telling them, which, as I said, is sort of like a fantastical secret agent romp, which, you know, at that point, everything that happens before makes more sense. You can still say it feels like kind of a cop-out, but then we pull back even further to number two and the girl, who was Death, who are the same actors that played Napoleon and the girl in the thing. Yep. And that's when number two gives this really hammy expositionary tie-up where he's like, put him in a room full of children. That'll get him to talk. Apparently that didn't work. And
she's like, well, it was a good idea, number two.
Yeah, it actually is. It actually is very similar to the way that Living in Harmony ends because it's done way worse.
Yes. Well, yes, it is done worse. It matches the tone of the episode.
It does, yeah.
So that kind of, it wouldn't have made sense to have like the Living in Harmony scene end this one.
Yeah.
It does, I don't know if it's a cop-out. It's just kind of, if they wanted to stick with that ending, I think the episode could have done a little bit better job of hitting the underlying, tension of the series that it doesn't really do. It's kind of weird because Six has been telling this story where he wins, but it doesn't really explain, like it doesn't really give any justification to anything. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of feels a little bit weak at the end when it's all said and done. It's like, oh, Six made up a story and he beat their silly little plan that is barely even a plan. It's kind of like just a fallback thing.
Right.
And then it all just doesn't really resolve into anything outside of that.
Yeah, I have some interesting things that I read on the AV Club that we can talk about the ending. But at that point, they go cut back to the screen in number two's office that they've been watching him on. And Six turns to the camera and says, good night, children, wherever you are, or something
everywhere.
Like that. Everywhere. And he's very clearly breaking the fourth wall.
Yep.
Where he's looking at number two, who is watching him, but he's also looking straight into camera.
Yep.
which is interesting. And I've seen some people have some thoughts about that are, you know, probably thinking too much about it, but God forbid you do that with this show.
Don't you dare.
All my life I've been looking for a worthy opponent. You have passed my first little test brilliantly. You'll be hearing from me again. Auf Wiedersehen.
Ha 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 But anyway, yeah, that's pretty much the episode. What did you think about it overall?
I liked it better the first time I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it in a way that was, maybe I wasn't like, this is objectively good, but I was like enamored by the silliness of it.
Yeah.
It was not nearly as good the second time I watched it because mm-hmm. it's a lot of filler. It's really just a lot of the chase between him and the girl goes on for a real long time. And once you know all the tricks that are going to happen, it's not nearly as interesting. And then I didn't really care for the ending. Mm-hmm. Like after they find Napoleon's army with the rocket, I was a little bit less enamored with it at that point. I don't think it's bad. I wish it was a little less similar to Living in Harmony.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of my main criticism, I think.
Would it change your opinion at all to learn that, when they were shooting this, McGoohan had to go back to the States for reshoots for Ice Station Zebra.
Oh, really? Yeah. So
the reason that he's dressed in that ridiculous outfit for most of the episode...
The Sherlock Holmes.
With the big mustache.
Yeah.
So they could use his stunt double and not and they could just push in on him for close-ups. So all of the stuff at the cricket thing, everything in a long shot, that's not him.
Yep.
So basically every time they push in on McGoohan, he's always... in a blue screen backdrop.
Yes, he is.
Blue screen, rear projection or whatever it is.
Yep.
And that's because for a lot of the long stuff, he wasn't there.
Oh, okay. It's not nearly as noticeable.
No.
It's not that bad. Like, I noticed it much more maybe because I knew it was happening in the brain switching.
Yeah, it's a much more elegant solution than the brain switching.
Yes, yeah.
If you can call this episode an elegant solution to anything.
Yeah, the green screen is real obvious. But I didn't think it would... It was no more distracting than some of the other times they've done it in previous episodes.
Yeah.
I wasn't crazy about it. This one in my notes, I had a lot of just underlined stuff. I wrote... these are all my first watching notes. So it's like, the steam room, Turkish bath, I have an arrow pointing to. This episode is fucking crazy in all caps. Because the Turkish bath scene is so bizarre.
Yeah, it's like a weird send-up of a James Bond thing or something.
If you were to make like a goof, like an Austin Powers version of a Bond death trap, you'd like put him in a steam box and put a fishbowl on his head.
Well, the thing that's interesting about this episode that was making me think about it a lot more as I was watching it was the whole thing to me seems like where in the story, like in the world of the prisoner, you can say, oh, this whole thing is a big middle finger to number two. I feel like, from the production angle, you could say that this episode is a big middle finger to what people were expecting from the show. Like, it's like they got so much criticism for it not being a generic spy show that they had this, they did this episode and basically took all of the shit you'd see on other shows at the time, whether it's the Avengers or even Danger Man or whatever, put it all in there and just... turned the volume up on everything. Just to be like, you know, this is kind of ridiculous, but this is what you want, so this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting to me to learn that... I've read that there's nowhere that can... I don't know if there's anywhere that can directly tie David Tomlin to saying this,
mm-hmm.
but supposedly this episode started as a Danger Man script that didn't get made. Now... after being familiar with Danger Man and being familiar with this show, I can say that probably everything that happens in this episode, it's not just like, oh, we changed the names and now it's a prisoner episode.
Yeah.
Because Danger Man is a lot more grounded.
Yeah.
I think, if anything, there was probably maybe the base level idea of, John Drake has to stop this guy from blowing up the city. That probably is from whatever script this was.
Yeah, and having to, like, chase a henchman, pursue his hitman henchman or whatever.
Yeah, but and everything that happens in it is probably blown out of proportion.
Right, kinda just, like, dress it up.
Kind of like the movie Airplane.
Yep.
The movie Airplane is actually a semi-remake of a serious drama
mm-hmm.
that the guys who made the movie were watching on TV one night, and it was so unintentionally funny that they bought the rights to it and made Airplane. So a lot of the dialogue from Airplane matches up with this
whole
movie, but it's just got all these other jokes thrown in. So I have a feeling it's something more along the lines of that, where the basic structure is from Danger Man, but then they were like, let's just have fun.
Yeah, we'll put him in Sherlock Holmes and yeah, have them wear like French army outfits and everything.
Right, yeah, and there's so much gunplay in this episode. For a show that has had no guns in it, well, except for Living in Harmony.
Yep.
This episode has multiple scenes of machine guns.
Yep.
Exploding rockets.
Yep, mortars. She's firing mortars.
Yeah, she's firing mortars, throwing grenades. giant city-killing rockets, yep. Exploding cricket balls. It's a very amped up episode.
Yeah.
It didn't occur to me how weird it was to see number six just like firing off a machine gun like he's in Predator.
Yes. You know? he did. He mowed down Jesse Ventura and just mowed down the baseboards.
Yeah, he was emptying the clip of Old Painless into the walls of that place.
Yeah, and the gun reminded me of a show that wrapped up recently. I guess that's all I'll say about it.
Okay.
It's kind of important to the end, so I won't say anything else.
But yeah, and especially that scene, there seemed to be like, at least on McGowan's face, there's like a some sort of like, or maybe I'm just like, this is the vibe I was getting, but there was something almost spiteful about the way he was using that machine. Like that's when it started to occur to me. It's like, maybe this is his way of being like, you want guns? Here's, cause the thing that makes me think that, oh, well, this couldn't be a Danger Man script, because John Drake didn't use guns either.
Right.
That was the whole point of his character. One of the big tenets was that he didn't use guns.
Yep.
So to have this secret agent character played by Patrick McGowan just firing off a clip of automatic weapon fire, it feels like a, you know, this is what you want, this is what you're going to get kind of thing.
Yeah, like a reverse psychology almost, sort of. It's, he doesn't kill anybody with it. He barely uses it for a little bit. It is. There's a lot of stuff becomes six in this too. He gets poisoned. He gets in a boxing match where it seems like he loses the boxing match because it cuts to him getting sort of knocked down to the mat. He's for him telling the story. He certainly takes his fair share of beatings in this one, and actually keeps on ticking.
Right. Yes. There is a gratuitous. But is one with a referee this time because he dressed as Sherlock Holmes getting sued into a boxing match with a man who is like, was he trying to tell him not to punch so hard or something?
I think he was trying to tell him where the girl was, right? Yeah. I don't understand why he knew that, because he could have just followed the girl. It's a little bit clunky narrative-wise, but it's kind of explained by just being the little story that he's making up. But yeah, he gets into a... I did love the scene of them exchanging information as they're actually boxing with each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun episode. I actually feel like it's easier to watch if you know how it's going to end. Because maybe you didn't feel this way, but I kind of feel like this is an episode where if you're watching The Prisoner cold, and then you get to this episode and this happens, it's probably very jarring.
Yeah.
More so... I would say probably even more so than the Western episode, because it's so weird.
It's more... The Western sort of... The Western's grounded in a way that this one isn't. Like, this one's... like, something's obviously off from this one.
And the Western is keeping true to the themes and the ideas that the show is set up to that point.
Yep.
But this one... It's just so. I mean, you could turn it on like and think you're watching the Avengers.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that goofy. And that's another reason that makes me think it's just like send all these people, because so many of these people worked on Danger Man and had been working in British television for so long.
Yeah,
I'm sure they did tons and tons of episodes of shows like this.
Yeah.
So it does feel like it's veterans of that style of show just taking the piss out of the stuff that they've been doing for the past 10 years.
Yep.
Like, the thing where they're in the car chase and she starts twirling the background,
yep.
That's completely ridiculous. But if you're a veteran of a television show where you spend a lot of time driving, quote-unquote, in front of backdrops, you know, I can see why you'd want to be like, isn't this kind of silly? Or just really point out the fact that, you know, I'm in front of a backdrop.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, a very meta take on the whole green screen car chase scene, which are always funny. They're always funny to watch, those things. I don't think anyone... Is there one that's ever aged well that you can look at and be like, no. Wow, look at that. That is fantastic.
Even ones they do now.
Yep.
It's like they keep getting slightly better. I feel like there was a point where they got it with that technology, and now they keep tweaking it, and they're past the point where it doesn't work anymore.
Oh, I feel that the technology has never caught up. They've never caught up that technology with what shows can do now.
Yeah.
If you watch a show now and they do it, it's always obvious when they're doing a scene that they're not actually driving. They're just in a backdrop. Like,
yeah.
You know, and the guys, there's like grips are just like pushing the car to make it look like it's yeah. rocking back and forth.
Yeah.
I feel like they could have mastered the art of getting that at this point. It must be the light or something. You know, the street lights yeah. never match with like the stuff that's going on, so it looks wrong out of context. It's just a weird holdover from a time, because technology hasn't changed that much since the 60s. You
yeah.
put someone in front and you put some fake footage in the background and have them like pretend to drive. With the always over-exaggerated hand motion yep. of the hand of the car that's not actually going
like,
that
like way. They've never driven a car before. I mean, hey, maybe they haven't. I don't know. There's actually a really good one in the movie War of the Worlds, the Spielberg movie,
uh-huh.
because he actually blended... He does like a crane shot kind of thing from outside the car that sort of goes by the side of the car and then across over into the windshield and
yep.
turns into one of those in the car shots.
Oh, right.
And you don't even realize what he did. Yep. I didn't realize it until someone pointed out. I was like, oh my God, that was a really good shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Same again, sir?
Oh, thank you. One of those is quite enough. Brandy. Whiskey, vodka, Drambuie. Tia Maria, Cointreau, Grand Marnier.
Sir, you'll make yourself sick. Hmm.
But yeah, this episode feels like a parody of spy shows.
Yes. It does. It's I don't know how to say it. It reminds me of the Royale, the Star Trek episode. I keep bringing that, but it's a kind of a similar thing where it's like you sort of have to let yourself go into it, and then it's sort of it's enjoyable for how just bizarrely goofy it is. I did appreciate the fact that he took the manliest solution to being poisoned ever, which is to just drink more.
Right. And I don't know why you couldn't just
instead make use your fingers.
Throw up. Yeah.
he orders a variety of liquors, I think, buying yeah. into the old myth that like if you mix liquor, you'll get sicker faster. Because he orders like Drambuie.
Yeah. And Grand Marnier. He says it very very accurately.
And it cuts like the barkeep trying to keep up is like comically being outpaced by how much she's drinking. Like she's got to keep up with as the empty glasses pile up. And then he just strolls into the bathroom to throw up. But yeah, he took the manliest route to getting sick, I think, possible, instead of just using the old fingers down the throat trick.
Yeah. And I think McGoohan's acting in this episode is good. But he's like, the thing that's so great about him is he can kind of adapt his weird, his hamminess is different than any other actor's hamminess I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He's good as a straight man for most of the episode, even in that, the bar scene where, you know, he's kind of like cracking wise. Like gallows humor kind of wise with the bartender.
Mm-hmm.
He's very straight. But then later on when he's tied up with Napoleon, there's a back and forth between them where Napoleon is telling him something and he's repeating it as though he's thinking it up himself.
Yeah.
But he's got that like higher lilt to his voice. Like,
yep.
Like he uses in A, B, and C when he talks about the dreamy party. That, you know, it's funny. I mean, he's a good actor. He knows how to take ridiculous things and make them work.
It reminds me, this episode also has his best Arnold Schwarzenegger-esque one-liner, where the Napoleon guys, I think this is what he says. It's something along these lines where he's like, soon I'll launch this missile, it'll be here, and you'll be the first person to know. He'll go, I'll go to pieces
yes,
over that.
Yes, yeah. And it's still, even there, it's very dry. It's very dry delivery. But yeah, he's very good. And that acting style works because this is, I think probably, this might be saying something, but this is one of the more surreal, this might be the most surreal episode they do.
Yeah, it's, yes. Because I didn't think the Western was that surreal. This one certainly is. And the village itself is kind of surreal, but less... The village feels like it's more just people wearing costumes.
Yeah.
And this one actually feels like it's like the world is weird because it is kind of a dream thing.
Right.
That said, I'm starting to miss the village at this point where I've done a couple episodes where we haven't done anything over there. And it's like, oh, I'd like to go back and see what's going on over there.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the lack of village footage is solely because they weren't getting a second season.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have the money or whatever to go back. Or if the entire plan was... I mean, I know the plan for the quote-unquote second season was to have fewer village-based stories.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's like it's not the same without the village. I mean, the village is such a character.
Well, I wouldn't have minded it if these two episodes weren't in a row. You know, if you would split them up a little bit, I'd be like, oh, like, here's one more episode where we're not really in the village all that much, but... Now, it certainly does feel like at this point in the production, their permit ran out at Port Marion or something, and they're like, well, we need to shoot outside of there for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing with the last three is that it really does feel like, all right, we're kind of out of ideas.
Yep.
We're not getting a second season. We have to wrap this up.
Right.
And I think...
I'd assume the last two must take place more in the village.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess technically you could say that. The interesting thing about the next episode, which we can talk about when we get there, but there's so much stuff about how McGoohan didn't know how the show was going to end, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
But the second to last episode was shot sixth.
Oh,
so
okay.
He'd already shot this first half of the two-parter. So I think it's less that he knew how it was going to end. I just don't think he knew how he was going to get there.
All right. Yeah.
But anyway, we can talk about that later.
I'm going to give you the most original death in history. You're going for a rocket ride.
Oh, the rocket. That reminds me. Where is it?
It is here.
Here?
All around you.
All around us.
The lighthouse itself is the rocket. You've guessed. I see. You're not the Duke of Wellington, are you?
Yeah, but between the last three we've watched, it's clear they've kind of out of ideas. But I think they found interesting ways to keep it going. It's so tough though, because if you took "Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling," "Living in Harmony," and "The Girl Who Was Death," and you remove them from the series as a whole, and you just showed someone those three episodes, I think they would be like, oh, this is kind of an interesting show. This is kind of weird. I don't think they would come off as "Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling," because that episode's horseshit. But
yeah.
but I think the problem is when you put it into the context of the show, the rest of the show has more or less it has so many hard ideas that they're playing with. In a very clearly defined world.
Yep.
That when you get to these ones, it's just sort of like, well, what happens if we put six here? Or maybe he can do this. Or it would be fun to do a parody of a spy show.
Yeah. I'll need to come up with a wrap-up idea, like a wrap-up idea show about what I think, I guess, after it's all said and done. But it's like because I kind of like these digression episodes. I didn't think this one was as good.
Mm-hmm.
I did like Living in Harmony. And I could see getting mileage out of these shows. I guess it's kind of hard to say now just because, you know, the two out of the three have not been particularly great, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I feel like the show has, room for growth outside of the village aspect. So I'm sort of torn about, because I always want to go back to the village, but at the same time, I kind of like the episodes that happen outside of it at a certain way.
Yeah, I think there's some sort of balance that they didn't quite find to making it work outside the village. Because you really have two options, which is either he gets out legitimately, like they did in Many Happy Returns and Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, and Chimes of Big Ben.
Yep.
I shouldn't say gets out. You know what I mean. They legitimately leave the village. Or you make it some sort of fantasy thing.
Yes.
And that's tough to keep doing.
Yeah.
I mean, theoretically, you could do something where, you know, six gets out. You know, like we were talking about Prison Break. It's like, well, once they get out of the prison, there's really not much left to do.
Right.
Unless you expand the walls of the quote-unquote prison.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess you could do something where the prisoner gets out and they actually have to, it's like a longer deal to get him to come back or something, but it's tough to do that if you're not doing multi-part episodes.
Yeah.
Because as TV was at the time, it was very much, here's the concept, you can jump in any episode and figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Which is tough to do if your show is The Prisoner, but he's out in the world, and it's like, well, is The Prisoner like a social construct? Or,
right, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Last week on The Prisoner, he got out.
He deals with the prisons of low tipping wages.
No, yeah, it's tough. Yeah, I have to think about my wrap up thoughts for what it would be. But it is like a, I think it's just the weakness of this. I wish this one wasn't so similar to Living in Harmony. That's kind of the main problem I think I have with it. Mm-hmm. Just that it's, you know, because I really like the. She has a line. What is her name? Even the girl who was Death in this. It's like, is it like Alice or something? I feel like he refers to her. Actually, maybe not.
Hold on a second. I just had it here.
But he, she has a line to them when they're in their that empty village where she's throwing like mortars at him as he's driving a bulldozer around.
Her name is apparently Sonia.
Sonia. Okay.
I don't actually know if they say that.
Yeah, I don't know if they say that either. It didn't sound familiar. She has a line where she's talking over the mega speaker to him, and she's like, I'm a born killer and you're a born survivor.
Yeah.
Which I enjoyed. Yeah. If they had done, because that does sum up what Six's thing is to the village anyway. He's just kind of a survivor who's going to keep going.
Right.
And I would have preferred, I think, if the episode focused on their interplay instead of just turning her into a henchman of.
So, we had a bit of a recording.
What happened?
we talked for a good hour and a half, and
we made points that no one had ever thought of.
Listen, there was dropping science and knowledge, and then there was what we did. We dropped knowledge on everybody. We would have, I don't want to say we would have changed the world.
Yeah.
But the world as we know it would not have been the same.
No.
Had you heard what we had said.
There was a glimmer of a portal to some netherworld opening just as we were dropping this knowledge. And
I was filling out the application to get the Nobel Peace Prize, which I think that's how it works, right?
You just apply.
Yeah, you just apply.
They read a whole bunch of applications.
Anyway, so we got cut off. We had a recording problem. But we're going to jump back into what we were talking about. We're going to talk about the ending of this episode.
Yeah. We went a little off topic, so we're not losing much.
Yeah,
we,
no. You missed like a good 20 minutes talking about television movies and how we could have fixed the Ghostbusters franchise.
We'll come back. There'll be a deleted scenes podcast where I'll recover that information. We can see what we're talking about. But yeah, let's get into the ending of this episode.
Yeah, I want to talk about the ending and the placement in the series. Where would you put it? Would you move it at all if you had to?
Yep, I was going to. I would move it earlier in the series. I think it comes too close to the ending where there's been a bunch of episodes that are too similar to what this idea is. And I think you can get away with moving this one a little bit away from those similar episodes, and you can put him in a place where it's after that peak of where he realizes that the village can't be escaped from.
Right.
And I would put it right like one or two episodes after that happens.
Right.
Sort of be his first sort of being content with where he is, kind of.
I at first thought that I could lose this episode completely. Because it's so weird and it's so different and it doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the show. Where, as we talked about, Living in Harmony, as different as it is, keeps true to all the same themes.
Yep.
But upon second, you know, watching it again for this, it occurred to me I would leave it exactly where it is. Because what I said last week about Living in Harmony being a good, breather, before the finale, I think that's what this episode is.
Yep.
Because even Living in Harmony is playing with the same themes and reinforcing a lot of stuff, even though it's got a different setup. This episode is very much just like a, all right, let's all kind of shake it out before we dive into what's coming next.
Yeah.
And I think it works that way. I think the content of the episode is, you know, whatever. It's fun.
Yep.
But, and I think my like of this episode is more based on that placing of it. But yeah, I wouldn't move it. I would leave it exactly where it is. And part of that, one of the, I disagree with you a bit about where it is in Six's character development. Because it was occurring to me when we get to the ending, and I found this review of the AV Club on the AV Club that actually kind of summed up my thoughts, where it says, at the end, Six looks to the camera and says to number two, number two's assistant and us at home, good night, children everywhere. It's the final nail in the coffin of the village's plans. Six has been enraged by their interference. He's been unsettled by them, sometimes terrified, always resistant, but now he barely considers them a threat. They're dangerous, of course, but so are toddlers if they're holding the wrong kind of scissors. The village has no choice but to play its final card, come good or come ill. And I think that's a really good observation.
Yep.
And it's unfair, really, for me to agree with that, because I feel like you can only, you only come to that realization if you know what comes next, which you do not, obviously.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because the next episode is very intense and it is very clear, like, they've got no other recourse. And I think if you look at this, if you look at this episode as I was saying earlier, from Six's perspective, where it's more of a big middle finger to the village and, you know, completely poo-pooing of what they're trying to do to him.
Yep.
And, you know, he's not even affected at all by the plan they pull on him.
Yes. He's definitely, yeah, he's the least combative out of anything he's ever done. He's because a lot of it has to do with the weakness of their plan in general, but he's right. Just kind, he's kind of, which I guess could be a sort of another way to look at it. Like, their plans are now just becoming increasingly
right.
Sort of silly.
It's almost like he's treating it like it's just a waste of time.
Right.
You know, yeah. He's just like, this is what I have to do today.
Yeah.
This is my job now.
Yeah, right. Putting up yeah. With this, shit. This is 9 to 5. He has to deal with these kids, say hello into the camera, and walk off in the sunset.
Kids who, I think, what do you think? Do you think that they are children of the village, or do you think that they were just like flown in for, they're like day rate working actor kids flown in for the day?
I think they're children of the village. Six seems to be on such good terms with them that he seems almost familiar with them, even though we haven't seen any kids in the village at this point.
Yeah.
And I think we might have mentioned before, but just the people who would be in the village that you think would have grown up there are a little bit older, so it's kind of questionable about how long they've actually been in the village.
Right.
It's your funeral and the other, oh, the Dance of the Dead. Well, the
right.
Girl claims to.
Right.
Been
there. And it also, I mean, the fact that they're there brings up, you know, we've kind of talked about it a little bit in the past, but like they never touch on that stuff at all in the show.
Yep.
And I think you were postulating, it's like, well, I mean, is everybody like sterilized or something when they
right.
get there? Like,
yep.
You know, there should theoretically be more kids because there's nothing else to do there except, you know,
right.
sleep and yep. have sex with people. Which, like you said, makes this place look a lot more appealing.
I know. It's really not that bad. Not that bad. You get a nice little scarf. You get to play chess all day. You don't really have any responsibilities. Although it seems like some people have jobs, which
yeah.
seems kind of a rough go at it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you wake up, you go out, you fix one of the cameras that blew out because
yep.
number six is messing with it. Then you go in and have some shock therapy. Get a nice lobotomy, and then you go home to your wife and kids. It's not bad. Then you go out to the cat and mouse and have a drink.
Yep. Pass off the watchmaking business to your daughter and the gift shop owner.
Thwart an assassination plot. Sounds like a good time. They should do a version of the Sims video game. That's just the village. From
oh my
prison.
God! I bet that's on YouTube. Actually, I would imagine that probably exists somewhere.
If it's not, it should be.
Yeah. I never got into The Sims. I feel like I should have. I missed that. That's a generation gone past.
My sister loves that game.
Yep.
Because she doesn't like... She likes video games, but she doesn't like video games with conflict.
Yeah.
although it's weird, because her two favorite video games are The Sims and Unreal Tournament.
Oh. Yeah, it was going to be like Call of Duty and Twisted Metal.
Yeah. Call of Duty and Petting Cats, the game.
Matt Rupp is God with children. He might give something away.
Well, it was worth a try, number two. He told them a blessed fairy tale. That one wouldn't drop his guard with his own grandmother.
So, how would you rate this genius plan of number twos?
Well, it's a one, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a generous one.
Yeah, it's a generous one that really feels like they just came in and were just like, well, this is the thing. It's obviously tacked on ending, yeah, too. They're just like, well, we have to tie this back somehow.
It actually feels like this number two is the most like a interim number two that they talk about, like in It's Your Funeral, like, yep, when number two's on vacation.
Yep.
This guy feels like one of those where he's like, hey, I don't even know what I'm doing here. I figured if we put him in a room with some kids, I don't know. Is that a thing? Do people talk to kids?
He can't, yeah, he's like at his desk on like a Monday morning, comes back to like 400 unread emails, and the guy's like, so what are we doing with six? And he's like, oh, the fuck, I've got to get, just put him over there with the kids and we'll deal with it. I mean, I know this.
Every time I'm at my sister's house, I talk to her kids a lot and I tell them really personal things. So that, I think that's normal, right? Like, I think that'll work.
Kids are very interested in why you chose to change your career path. I find they're always looking for firemen stuff, and I will just tell them exactly why I don't want to be a spy.
Honestly, though, that would feel more legit if there was a scene where he was talking to the kids, and the kids like, but why did you resign? It's like, well, actually, wait a minute.
They could have. That's such a kid trope of like, what do you want to be when I grow up? Like, kids, yeah, would be like,
if they had just put him in a room with a 3-year-old, yeah, who's in that phase where everything you say, they say why.
it would have broken him. It's just, yeah, you cut to the kid saying why, and then it just cuts to two like going through the door, and six is just like collapsed on the ground. And the
do
kid,
you live here? Yes. Why? Well, because they brought me here. Why? Because I resigned from my job. Why? Well, I mean, I can't tell you that. Why? Shut up! You're driving me nuts.
The village has control. That would have actually been a nice time. Even just a clever
spoiler alert. That's the last episode.
Oh, that's too bad. Even just a clever one off to the camera. Yeah, like if the kid had just mentioned that. Now I'm rewriting the episode, but it would have been interesting.
See, that's the thing. With this episode, I find the most interesting things about this episode to be the peripheral things.
Yeah,
like the placement, the intention of the placement. Whether or not this whole thing was just kind of like an FU to the spy genre.
Yeah, that's true. It's a more interesting episode for like the meta level stuff,
yes,
than,
yeah,
because there's really not a lot that goes on. It's really a chase scene for a good portion.
Yeah, I mean, for a show where a good number of the episodes you have to really watch and pay attention to.
Yep.
Much like Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, this is an episode you could watch while you're folding laundry and not miss anything.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yes.
I mean, again, though, it is one that doesn't have a lot of dialogue. And we have established that those tend to be the better ones.
Yep.
And maybe while this isn't as good, it's still well directed. I think Tomlin was a good director, and he did a lot with what he had, which unfortunately wasn't a lot.
Yeah, but that's funny you say the laundry thing for Do Not Forsake Me. Yes, that's one of the brain switching one.
Yeah.
Cuz I feel like that one is, I feel like that's an episode where if you watch The Prisoner a lot, you could justify Do Not Forsake Me being better than it is.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I feel like the plot of Do Not Forsake Me is confusing enough to the point where if I was not paying attention, I'd be even more confused about what the hell is going on.
Yeah, I guess. I guess the reason I say the other way is because it is such a, from the majority of it is such a standard spy show.
Yeah.
That, I mean, even though the mind swap thing happens at the beginning, it plays into it so, like, the science fiction aspect isn't there.
Right.
For the most of the episode, it's mostly just like a spy show.
Yeah.
So I feel like you could throw that on and kind of, you know, be like, oh, okay.
I suppose that's true. Yeah, it's just the sort of overall level of whose body is in who and what's going where. It's like you kind of have to pay attention to the plot of
that's
that
true.
One.
That's a good point.
Even though I don't think the plot is particularly good. I don't even know if it makes sense, really. But it's like, yeah. I was watching it while I was trying to pay attention, and I wasn't totally on board with what they were trying to explain as the plot of what's going on.
Right.
Like, you know, because you have to think about why Six would hunt down the scientist. Like, what's his concern? He wants his body. It's all very, nothing is filled in for you, you kind of have to infer a lot out of that episode. Or if they do say it, they say it in like a one-off sentence and hope that the viewer is paying attention to it.
Right, right.
But that would be the one difference. Like this one, I feel like this one you could definitely just put on, and this one I mean The Girl Who's Deaf, you could just put on, watch it, and be like, oh, there it is. There's nothing deep about it, really. It's just kind of going.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, we already talked about it all, but like the Six using a gun feels really weird, and it's such a surreal outlier from the rest of the show.
Yep.
But so a little bit of trivia. I think we talked about a bunch of it, but so apparently The Girl Who Was Deaf was originally conceived as a two-part story, and a psychedelic piece with the hero in a maze was one of the sequences that never got filmed. This was envisaged for the movie or two-part version. Lou Grade said a longer version would never sell, and I agree with him because I mean, an hour of this is barely like I don't want to say barely watchable, but like I don't even know how you would stretch this longer than it is.
Yep. And, yeah. This is where we lost our tangent, where we started talking about movies that were not made. Yeah, but if you made this a movie, you'd have to double the length of each half here, so the chase would be one, and then the resolution would be one. And the resolution is not interesting enough to carry an hour. And the chase is only interesting in how absurd.
Unless you really like bad dubbing, then the ending is pretty good. But
or just you're a military history buff, and you're like, look at the actual true to nature uniforms these people wear. Beautiful. Yeah, is that a French thing where they hold their hand? What was that about?
I think it was specifically a Napoleon thing.
Okay.
Because every picture you see of Napoleon, or at least that one famous painting, he's doing that.
Doing that.
So anytime someone's playing Napoleon, the reason you know it's Napoleon is because he's holding it like that. Shirt. Yeah.
Is that why he yelled at his underling to take his hand out?
I think it was because everybody was doing it.
Okay.
And
only be one Napoleon,
yeah,
I guess.
It wasn't as cool if everyone was doing it. but yeah, and also like if this episode had been a movie of The Prisoner, that would have been awful.
Yeah.
Because I mean, if you're someone who's watching this show since the beginning, right?
Yep.
And you've got The Prisoner concept, Port Marion, all of that stuff that you're familiar with, and then you go to see the movie. I don't know if it would be a go to see movie or a TV movie or what, but either way, it's like, what the hell is this?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
You love this show, and when they actually do a longer piece, it's just like a Austin Powers movie, basically. Yes. I don't know. That would have been
very, very disappointing. Yeah. What episode do you think would make the best movie?
What episode would make the best movie? I think the fictional two-parter that I talked about when we were covering, I want to say Hammer and Anvil.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the one where that felt to me felt like a two, like Hammer and Anvil felt like the second half of a two-parter.
Yes.
So the first half was all about seeing how awful number two was being. Mm-hmm. And then the second half was Six just
getting his comeuppance.
Yeah. I think that would have been a much better movie, that kind of concept.
Yep.
Because, you know, it's self-contained. And if it had been written better, I think it would have been pretty satisfying.
Yeah.
As long as you're not expecting any answers. Because, I mean, I think when you get into something like that, one of the traps you could fall into is, oh, well, the movie is clearly where they're going to answer all the questions. Like,
right, yeah.
We talked a little bit in our lost tapes here about the X-Files movie, and I think that's one of the problems that you run into with that movie is you get to a certain point in that show where there are so many questions, they have to answer some when they get to the movie.
Yeah.
And whether or not you're satisfied with those answers is up for debate.
Yeah, probably not.
So yeah, I mean, but then you have the second X-Files movie, which is basically a Monster of the Week thing, which was a better idea for a movie, but a shitty movie. So mm-hmm. You know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, kind of. But
yeah, I'd choose what's the one where he escapes and it's on a boat and it's very quiet. There's no dialogue.
Oh, Many Happy Returns.
I would make Many Happy Returns the movie. I think
that's interesting. The only reason I wouldn't go with that is because I don't think the plot of that one is strong enough to carry for 2 hours.
No, you'd have to alter it to him going back to destroy the village. Like, he wouldn't be captured again or
like,
something.
And if you're thinking in terms of a movie, I think you have to think about, like, well, what things from the show do you have to make sure you're going to do? And, like, there's barely any village in that episode.
Yep.
And, I see where you're going though, because that is definitely the most, one of the more cinematic episodes.
Yep. If you, well, I guess I'm, yeah, I'm thinking of if you made a movie that was about the prisoner, I think you, the storyline would be Many Happy Returns. Like if you did the first hour of his capture and like the middle act is his escape and then the final act is him coming back, I feel like you could map that one out. I think for an, if, I think if you were making a movie for fans, I think Hammer and Anvil works better.
Yeah, or the, I was thinking along the same lines though, I would even possibly say Chimes of Big Ben. Because Chimes of Big Ben hits all of those beats.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah.
I just like the twist of two being the woman who helps him is a very movie thing. That feels much more than knowing that Leo McKern is number two because you've met him at the start.
That's true. Yeah, that's interesting. There actually was a movie of the prisoner in the works for a while. I think Christopher Nolan was briefly attached to it.
Oh, really?
But I just don't think the show, the concept works contained to a two-hour movie.
Yeah, you'd have to
if that's
really
your first
whittle it
thing,
down.
Yeah, if that's your first thing, I don't think it works the way it does as a show.
Yeah.
Some more trivia. The character of the bowler at the cricket match was played by an actor named John Drake, who apparently McGowan chose because his name was John Drake and thought that it would be fun and confusing, which, you know, I think is great and is something that just tells me he knew exactly what he was doing when he was doing this stuff. It's supposed to be ambiguous. It's supposed to raise these questions so you have these conversations. You're not supposed to know whether or not number six is actually John Drake.
Find me the best acting John Drake you can. I'll give him
find
no dialogue.
Find me a John Drake who is an actor and also a professional cricket bowler. This is one of only three episodes out of 17 where number six uses a firearm. Actually, you know what? If I were to make a movie after this whole show had been on,
yep,
I would just troll the shit out of everybody and make the movie Living in Harmony.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I feel like you could get away with that because it's like, well, this isn't really the prisoner I know, but it's also really satisfying, so I don't really know if I'm mad about it.
It's true. It has all the actors I'm expecting, but this is not what I was expecting at all. That's a pre-internet movie that you could have. That's like a Blair Witch thing. Yes. You know, it's like you can't have that in the internet era because everyone would be like, what the fuck was this?
Yeah. Most of the cricket match was filmed at Eltisley in Cambridgeshire, but number six can
next
only
to be the Hobbit hole.
Yeah. But number six can only be seen in a long shot or from behind. The close-ups were later filmed in a field behind MGM Studios a week later, obviously because he was off shooting Ice Station Zebra or doing reshoots.
I feel his cricket outfit would be a great Halloween costume. It's very, like, with his little striped hat, his facial hair, and his white cricket outfit.
Yeah, if there are prisoner cosplayers out there, you should do that one.
Why do cricket players wear painter jumpsuits is the weirdest.
No idea.
What a weird uniform you play that game in.
Yeah, I have no clue. The Sherlock Holmes disguise in the boxing match and the funfair was not in the original script. It was changed to allow Frank Mir, Patrick McGowan's stunt double, to play number six during McGowan's absence from filming, which I think is, I just love that they did that. I wonder, was that the impetus for the surrealism of this episode? Or do you think that was just like part of what they were like, it was like surreal already. So they were like, you know what? What if we just give you like a really weird costume that we can cover your face in?
Yeah, I think it just amplified it, right? They probably had all these ideas. And then the fact that McGowan wasn't there to do it just made everything one step weirder on a technical level that you had to do. Like, you're like, well, we have to cover these seams.
This episode had three actors from Danger Man, from the Danger Man film Karoshi, which is the final two episodes of Danger Man.
Yep.
Kenneth Griffith, that's a hard name to say.
Yes.
Patrick McGowan and Christopher Benjamin, who appears as a character called Potter in both. Benjamin claims he was unaware of the connection and played them as different characters, though some fans claim they are connected. And this is another link which proves that number six is in fact John Drake from Danger Man.
Mm-hmm.
Something McGowan denied, but George Markstein said, of course it's Drake. I think honestly, not an accident. I think he knew what he was doing.
Yep.
Or they knew what they were doing. Though the fact that this, like, I know that this script supposedly started as a Danger Man script, but I think we covered this before the thing cut out.
We did.
I don't think it was like they just changed the names.
Yeah.
So the fact that he was the same character was probably not a coincidence, but it it's not a linking factor.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And this is the only time children are shown in the village, who are presumably children of the inmates, which we kind of debated.
Mm-hmm.
However, the maid in Arrival also says that she grew up in the village and has lost her parents, and a villager has an adult daughter and it's your funeral, which I think we talked about a little bit.
Yes.
Sleep. I'll come tomorrow. I don't think I have any other important appointments.
Yeah, so, oh, the other thing I want to mention is, there is a series, there's a company called Big Finish that has been doing audio dramas of Doctor Who and whatnot for a while, and they just announced recently that they will be doing audio dramas based on The Prisoner, and they released their first batch of information about what they were doing. Some of the episodes are going to be like adaptations or semi-adaptations of episodes of the show, and some are going to be brand new series, brand new stories.
Yep.
They announced some specifics of the first episode, which is called Departure and Arrival. The specifics being that the setup is something to the effect of, when a top secret meeting in Belgium goes bad, Agent ZM73, has to resign his post and finds himself in the village. Which, right away, I mean, I know the guy who's doing it, it means well and is putting a lot of work into it, but that much info on Six's backstory right away makes me really wary of it, because,
yeah,
you know, as we talked about, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, that stuff, you don't need it.
TMI.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's different because it's an audio thing. Who knows?
They should just reboot it with a new secret agent. They discover the village, and he goes into... figure something out about it, and he meets Six still inside.
That's what I can't remember if I mentioned this on the show or if we were just talking about it. But if I redid The Prisoner,
yep,
I would put numbers. I would have a completely different character, and I would put number Six in there as like kind of like that character in Checkmate, the older like general guy.
Yep,
more like that, where Six has been there for a while.
And the mentor.
Yeah, he knows what the deal is and all that kind of stuff. And if you wanted to twist it and make him number two at the end of the show, you could do that. You know, you could do tons of stuff. But yeah, I think that would be interesting. Yeah. And speaking of things that are not, you know, things, other versions of the show and characters, I think next week we will be doing an episode. We will be taking a cue from the show itself and having a breather before our big finale push.
Aperitif before, to cleanse the palate before.
And we will be covering a couple episodes of Danger Man. We'll be covering the first episode of Danger Man, which the name of which escapes me at the moment, but it's the very first episode in the series, and it takes place in Port Marion, which is where McGoohan first saw the place and remembered it for when he did The Prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be covering Colony 3, which is from a later season after it turns into Secret Agent, which it's interesting because there's some changes because in... I love that people are super concerned about the continuity between John Drake and The Prisoner.
Yep.
But the first season of Danger Man, John Drake is American. And the second season of Danger Man, John Drake is English. So
he is a man of many faces.
Or it's possibly reversed, but I think I'm right. It will become Colony 3, which is from Secret Agent.
Yep.
So I think it's like season 2 of Danger Man, or I can't remember.
Okay.
Which is a very, very Prisoner-esque episode. It's a very cool episode. And I think I'm on the fence about whether or not we should do Kiroshi, the two-part finale. I want to say yes, just because I watched a bit of it, and he seems to be playing John Drake a little bit closer to the way he plays Six.
Yep.
So all of these things, you can actually watch them on YouTube. You don't have to go and buy them if you want to. If you want to follow along, you can find
this podcast them. Not supported by YouTube or Google.
If you want to follow along and watch those episodes as well, you can do so on YouTube. But if not, hopefully it'll still be interesting for you. And I mean, you might already be familiar with the show already.
Yeah.
But so that's what we'll be doing next week. You have anything you want to plug?
Sure. We're doing a Star Trek podcast. Clay helps out occasionally with a bevy of other characters. You can go to the Penske podcast to listen to all that. You can find it on iTunes. And otherwise, you can go to YouTube and search for the Penske file. And it's a channel there where I put up a bunch of my stuff.
Cool, cool. And as always, I am by no means an expert at any of this, so if you have anything you'd like to correct me on or anything you'd like to talk about, you can contact us at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter. Please follow us on Twitter, @prisonerpodcast. And if you happen to be listening through iTunes and you like the show, please leave us a rating or a review. We'd be much obliged.
You should go out and rate all the podcasts you listen to. It's very helpful to them.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, some people just like to feel loved, you know? And you don't want to feel like you're in a basement talking to nobody.
I will say that, I don't know if I've talked about this on this podcast. I have talked about it. iTunes makes it so unsatisfying when you rate something.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you no indication that your vote worked. Because when you click on it and you give it like 3 out of 5 stars or whatever, it'll say, got it. And then you log off and you go back on and it doesn't remember your ratings. It's not like Netflix that show you what you've previously rated things.
Right.
It'll give you the impression that you can vote again, even though you can't vote again, and it won't remember what you called the rating, which is obnoxious. If that's how they're going to sort their podcast, you'd think they'd have come up with a better system of doing things. But anyway.
Despite that, you should still rate.
Write some hate mail to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating.
Please don't do one of those like 1 star, because I find the rating system very unsatisfactory, and I learned about it from this podcast.
The Amazon reviews that get angry about the shipping, and they rate the UPS. They're like, UPS took 5 days to get this perfect product to me.
My friend left the best Amazon review. There was a when the second Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man 2 with Jamie Foxx's Electro came out, they had a special edition of it that was... The disc came in like a bust of Jamie Foxx as Electro.
Okay.
And he thought it was the most preposterous thing ever.
Yeah.
So he went onto Amazon. You can find this review on there still. Wrote a 1-star review that said, like, I gave this 1 star because I don't know how I thought I was going to be able to have sex with this thing. And there is no way for me to have sex with it. And I'm very unsatisfied.
Oh, troll reviews. I love them.
Yeah, they're pretty good. Anyway, so we will see you next week with some talk about Danger Man. So we'll see you then.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, there you go. There was The Girl Who Was Death. Thanks so much for coming back and listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget to head over to backinthevillage.com where you can find some very helpful links to help you follow along with our Danger Man episode next week. But yeah, that's it. So we will see you next time with a little bit of Danger Man. Or Secret Agent, depending if you're from America. But who cares, really? It's the same show, right? All right, see you next time. Bye.
Good night, children. Everyone.